Bob Kendrick is president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, and he will be giving a presentation tonight. I'll be talking to him tonight at Pitch Talks, and we're very pleased to be joined in studio by Bob Kendrick. Bob, thank you so much for doing this. Welcome to Toronto. Welcome to our studio. We talked a little bit off the air. I've been lucky enough to go to the Negro League Museum in Kansas City, and we've talked about it in the past year, and anytime I talk to anybody, I tell them, first of all, Kansas City to me is one of the great underrated baseball cities in the United States. But if you go there, you absolutely have to go to the Negro Leagues Museum. Now, I wanted to ask you, the success of the Kansas City Royals in the past couple of years, has that kind of helped? Because I know for a while there was some funding issues with the Negro League Museum. Thankfully, now things seem to be back on track. But did you find that with the success of the Royals, baseball fans sort of started to migrate a little more over to the museum as well?
Oh, no doubt, Jeff. And really, it goes back a little bit before that. It goes back to 2012 in the All-Star Game in Kansas City hosting the All-Star Game. Mm-hmm. And really, the Negro Leagues Museum became the star of the All-Star Game. Aside from the things, the activities that were happening at the stadium, the focus was on the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And so it was a godsend to have an event, a national, international caliber event like the All-Star Game. Then that just carried us right on into what happened, you know, the improbable 2014 mm-hmm. playoff run. Nobody saw that one coming. And then it goes into a World Series run, and then the next year to get back into the playoffs and win the World Series created a level of baseball euphoria that we had not seen since 1985. Well, in 1985, the Negro Leagues Museum didn't exist.
Right.
So it was our first World Series opportunity as well, and people responded beautifully.
You know, I got to ask you, why Kansas City?
Because Kansas City is the birthplace of the Negro Leagues. That is where the Negro Leagues were formed in 1920. A guy by the name of Andrew Rube Foster, genius. One of the greatest baseball minds this sport has ever seen, and nobody knows anything about him. He led a contingent of 8 independent black baseball team owners into Kansas City. They met at the old Paseo YMCA, and out of that meeting, the birth of the Negro National League.
So those teams existed independently.
They did.
And did they play, you know, were they, did they play against each other, or were there, what was there before that meeting?
Yeah, black baseball has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
And so these teams, as you mentioned, were already in existence. But they didn't have an organized structure. It was very haphazard. And so essentially, booking agents were taking all the money, and guys were just jumping around from team to team. And so Rube Foster gave it that guiding hand that it needed in an organized sense. Mm. And then the Negro Leagues would go on to operate for 40 incredible years, from 1920 until 1960.
And you know, I think people are going to be surprised to hear the 1960 part of that. You know, that
absolutely.
Right, that it continued that long.
Absolutely, because we can all relate that Jackie breaks the color barrier in 47. And I think the general assumption is if Robinson breaks the color barrier in 47, if there was a Negro League, surely it would have ended in around that time. Mm-hmm. But when we go back historically, it took Major League Baseball 12 years before every Major League team had at least one black baseball player. And Boston being the last to integrate in 59.
Right. And I think people need to realize, too, that Negro Leagues, there's pretty good attendance.
Yeah.
I mean, I think people don't realize that there were times where the Negro Leagues actually outdrew the quote-unquote Major League teams in their cities.
It is. And, you know, Jeff, I think one of the most difficult things for even the people who come to visit us to accept and to really understand is that there were two professional baseball leagues operating parallel to one another. Mm-hmm. One that gave the best white baseball player an opportunity to showcase his world-class skills. The other that did the exact same thing for the best black and Hispanic ball player to showcase their world-class baseball skills, but both were professional. Now, the Negro Leagues weren't as well funded as the Major Leagues were, but the quality of play was just as good, some will say even better. And so you're right. They were outdrawing many major league teams across this country. And so once you started, however, to kind of take that talent away, black fan base followed their black stars because of natural curiosity. We want to see how they're going to fare now that they had an opportunity to take field with these white players. And so ultimately it killed the Negro League.
What was the peak, Bob? What was kind of the golden era of the Negro Leagues?
You had two.
Okay.
In those early 20s, right after Foster created the league, blew up. Oh man, 400,000 fans in the first year.
And where are they playing? Are they playing in the same stadiums that major league teams are playing?
They really were primarily. Now there were several Negro
like
League
Kansas
owners.
City, there's no major league team then, right?
But yeah, there were several Negro League owners who ultimately built their own stadiums, but for the most part, they were dependent on using major league stadiums, which is why you'll hear people say, well, the schedule was so haphazard. Well, it really wasn't, because they had to wait until the major league schedule was complete so that they could then build their schedule based on when the major league club was on the road.
So let me get this straight. Their major league owners wouldn't allow black players in their game, but they were more than willing to allow black fans and black players to play in their stadium so they can make money, right?
America is a capitalistic society.
Yeah, funny that way, right?
Yeah, because there were teams that were making money off the Negro Leagues. We recently acquired documents from 1945 that quantify and verify that in 45, the New York Yankees made over $100,000 off the Kansas City Monarchs alone, because the Monarchs were playing at Yankee Stadium. They were playing across the river in New Jersey, over in Newark, and, of course, in Blues Stadium in Kansas City, where the Yankees minor league Kansas City Blues were playing. $100,000 in 1945 was pretty good money.
Wow.
Now, were those the stands would have been, in some places at least, would have been segregated, right, during some of those
years?
In
the Deep South.
In the Deep South.
In the Deep South. But what you saw was that there were a lot of white fans who saw black baseball. And now in Birmingham, we weren't going to sit together. But in most parts of the country, not only were they in attendance, we were sitting side by side. At major league games, we were separated, usually by a chicken wire barrier. Black fans would be isolated either down the left or right field lines in those stadiums and then separated from white fans in the rest of the ballpark by chicken wire. But at Negro League games, for the most part, we sat side by side watching the best baseball being played in this country.
That's what I'm thinking of, that because I've seen that image of the segregated stands, you know, in baseball. But the idea that when the Negro League team played, you could sit wherever you wanted.
Sit wherever you wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could sit wherever you wanted. And so, to me, that's what makes the irony of this great story so pertinent. A league born out of segregation becomes the driving force for social change in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, baseball is such a, I think a lot of people, and we're joined by Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. You know, for the longest time, people view baseball, and a lot of people still view it as kind of a hidebound sport, you know, a sport that's slow to change. But, and I'm not trying to paint baseball owners from back then as saints, but the fact of the matter is the game was integrated well before American society was integrated.
Well before. And Jeff, we make at the museum make the bold assertion that Jackie Robinson's breaking of the color barrier wasn't just a part of the civil rights movement in the United States. It was the beginning of the civil rights movement. You think about this, 1947. That's well before those more noted civil rights occurrences. That's before Brown versus the Board of Education. That's before Rosa Parks' refusal to move to the back of the bus. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., as Buck O'Neill would so eloquently say, was a sophomore at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, when Jackie signed his contract to play in the Dodger organization. President Truman would not integrate the U.S. military until a year after Jackie. Mm. That started the ball of social progress rolling in our country.
Although it's interesting, Bob, because, you know, it's, and I think that kind of talks about the power of the institution of baseball in America as well, because, you know, there were African-American professional football players, you know, Fritz Pollard, guys, you know, that now the NFL was not the NFL then.
Exactly.
You know, Joe Louis was the heavyweight champion, right? And so was Jack Johnson. But Joe Louis especially is a very significant social and political figure.
Jesse Owens in track,
right? But until baseball changes, right, because of where baseball is culturally in the United States, that's, you know, that's why the Robinson is, you know, why that sets off a wave in the way that those other things didn't set off a wave, it seems to me.
Because baseball was, and I think still is, America's national pastime.
Yeah.
You know, the other sports have risen to great heights now in esteem and in their prevalence, but it's still not baseball. And baseball is still the most romanticized sport of them all. And so it led the way. America literally jumped on the coattail of baseball. And that is what jettisoned and started the ball of social progress rolling in the U.S., baseball.
People, I don't think, realize who played.
Oh, man.
People are going to say, there are people who recognize Buck O'Neill, Satchel Paige, but Hank Aaron, played in the Negro Leagues. Willie Mays played in the Negro Leagues. Who were some of the other players that people would know?
So many greats. My favorite picture in the museum is a picture of a young, he must have been 17, 18 years old, Hank Aaron, standing at the train station in Mobile, Alabama. Mm. And guys, all he has is a little duffel bag.
Right.
He was on his way to go join the Indianapolis Clowns at that time. Now, Hank at that time was a skinny, cross-handed hitting
infielder. Cross-handed, that's right.
Yeah, he was a right-hand hitter hitting with his left hand
that's
on
right.
top. That's unorthodox. The fear you break your wrist hitting in that manner. Hank Stephen is knocking the cover off the baseball in a highly unorthodox fashion, and he leaves there. And when we had him there in 1999 for his first visit, and we said, Hank, why? His nickname then was Pork Chops.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Before he became the Hammer, he was known as Pork Chops because apparently all he ate was pork chops and fries. When he traveled on the road, they nicknamed him Pork Chops. But he told me in this duffel bag, he maybe had two changes of clothes.
Mm-hmm.
He had $1.50 in his pocket and a ham sandwich that his mama had made him going to chase that dream.
That's great.
It worked out pretty good for the Hammer.
Yeah.
But you're right. When you start talking about Willie Mays and the great Ernie Banks, who played in Kansas City for Buck O'Neill, and then Buck sent him on to Chicago. Elston Howard, who was roommates with Ernie Banks in Kansas City. The great Roy Campanella, one of the greatest catchers of all time, came out of the Negro Leagues. The late Monty Irvin, who we lost earlier this year, who could have very easily been the first African-American player in the major leagues. Monty had everything that Jackie had. And quite frankly, Monty was a better baseball player at that time than Jackie. Monty Irvin was a superstar in the Negro Leagues for the Newark Eagles. These guys became household names. But if you really want to quantify the impact that the Negro Leagues had on Major League Baseball, I think there's one little factoid that brings it to light. From 1949 to 1959, 9 of 11 National League MVPs were former Negro League stars.
Wow.
Now, you have to keep in mind the American League was very slow to integrate.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, they were a little behind the curve, which is one of the reasons the National League dominated the All-Star games during that period of time.
Bob, was there, in terms of the integration of the minor league, so everybody knows Jackie Robinson played in Montreal, played for the Montreal Royals before he went to play for the Dodgers. But was there a lag, you know, after Robinson breaks the color barrier, and so that it must have been a stretch there where the best African-American ball players were still playing in the Negro Leagues, like the young players, before they started to integrate the minor league system and bring guys through that way?
Yeah, but after 47, man, I tell you, when Jackie breaks the color barrier, those teams, those Negro League teams that were out east, almost died instantly because they lose their fan base.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, this migration of that young African-American talent was now moving into the major leagues. Well, in 1947 alone, 5 guys get called up to the major leagues.
Mm-hmm.
See, everybody knows about Jackie. A few more folks know about the great Larry Doby.
Mm-hmm.
But the other 3 are the answers to a trivia question when we start talking about Hank Thompson, Willard Brown, and Dan Bankhead. And, of course, Dan Bankhead actually played here in Canada over a period of time, was a great pitcher, electric stuff. A lot of people think that Satchel was the first pitcher from the Negro Leagues into the major leagues, but he wasn't. It was Dan Bankhead, who was out of Alabama. Great arm. I mean, just electric stuff. But when he gets to the major leagues, he was afraid to pitch inside. Buck surmises that he was scared of what would happen if he hit a white batter. And so he wouldn't pitch inside. And I don't care how great your stuff is. If you can't get guys off the plate, you're not going to be able to get them out unless your name is Satchel Paige.
Right. Right.
So, Bob, what were the, you know, again, because I think the 1960 thing, that is going to surprise people because people think of this as ancient history. And I know for some people that's ancient history, but for some of us, that's within our lifetime, right? What were those last years of the Negro Leagues like?
It was tough. It was tough because that the owners had seen the handwriting on the wall almost immediately. You know, the interesting thing about it is J.L. Wilkinson, who owned the Kansas City Monarchs, never got paid a dime for Jackie Robinson, a player he had under contract. Branch Rickey literally came in and took Jackie Robinson away from J.L. Wilkinson. But Wilkinson couldn't fight back. You know why? Wilkie was white. Wilkie had made his entire living in black baseball. So if Wilkie stands up and protests what black folks had been waiting for forever.
Oh, of course.
He's damned if he did and damned if he didn't, because he wouldn't have been protesting the fact that a black man was going to play in the major leagues. He would have been protesting the fact that you're taking a black player from me, but you're now about to put me out of business.
Yeah.
He sold the Monarchs to his business partner the very next year. So the owner started to see what was about to happen here. So what did they do? they started selling their star players to the major leagues, trying to get whatever they could get before the business of black baseball died.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just a few months later, or actually a few weeks later, Bill Veeck comes over to go get Larry Doby from F.A. Manley.
Yep.
Well, Mrs. Manley says, hell no. No, if you want him, you will pay me. Well, he paid a $15,000 for a future Hall of Famer. But that set the tone now. That set the tone.
So they just start selling off the assets. But it's amazing it lasted that long.
It was. And it only lasted that long because you had these Midwestern-based teams mm-hmm. that weren't close
they weren't
to
major league cities. Yeah,
yep.
Makes sense.
We're in conversation with Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. There's also a Canadian aspect to this, isn't there?
Of course.
Because, the integration of society, the integration of Major League Baseball is you know, a wonderful thing. It was the righteous thing. It was the right thing to do. But there were a lot of players in the Negro Leagues who weren't good enough. I mean, and not just because of race, but just they weren't good enough to go to the majors. And when the Negro Leagues started to sort of wither away, a lot of these players, I don't know how many people know this, but a lot of these players ended up playing in Manitoba.
Mm-hmm.
They played in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. They played in Alberta. A lot of them came up here. But I mean,
Ottawa.
I told this story off air about how in my town, Morden, which is in southern Manitoba, Carmen, which is a town near Morden, Carmen, Winnipeg, there was places in North Dakota. There was kind of a league, and it kind of started out barnstorming. Then it became the Mandak League.
Yes.
And, you know, there's a guy who lives, my mother's 93 years old. There's a guy who lives in the street next to her who played as a 14-year-old boy with Walter Gibbons, Bubblegum Gibbons. Great. And I didn't know this. I mean, I grew up in this town. I covered baseball for 20 years. And like mm-hmm. I told Stephen, I went to the Negro Leagues Museum. I thought, okay, this is kind of interesting. Did some more work. I found a woman who lived in Winnipeg who'd done a research paper on this. I started going through it. And she'd compiled all the stuff. And Bob, there was a time where there were three or four Negro League Hall of Famers playing in Carmen.
Yes.
In Winnipeg,
yes.
In Brandon. Brandon had great teams. Tell us a little bit about the role that Canada played and how a lot of Negro League players just kind of migrated to Western Canada in particular.
Yeah. Well, and I think really after the integration of the game, the major leagues put their focus on that young star. And so these guys who likely would have been good enough to play in the major leagues, they were just too old. And so the major leagues didn't want them, and the Negro leagues didn't want them because they couldn't sell them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they ultimately found home in Canada and continued their baseball careers either in the minor leagues or in the various Canadian leagues. And so many of them, you know, found great solace in Canada. But we go back well before the integration of the game, you know, with Negro League players barnstorming into Canada. As we were talking off air, J.L. Wilkinson brought his Kansas City Monarchs on several Canadian tours. They brought the House of David with them.
Yep.
And for those who are listening, the House of David was an all-white religious sect based out of Benton Harbor, Michigan,
mm-hmm.
characterized by their very long hair and very long whiskers because they were trying to mimic David from the Bible.
Yes.
Play a great role, however, in black baseball because they would barnstorm all over the country playing with and against Negro League teams.
They're like the Washington Generals,
exactly,
kind of, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's what they're
most notably the Kansas City Monarchs.
Yeah.
And so Wilkie would bring the House of David, brought the lights with mm-hmm. them. They had the portable lighting system,
yep.
brought the lights in with them. And so this was a very common occurrence where Negro League players would barnstorm their way into Canada and they were treated so much better. You know, and mm-hmm. that would be the same for them when they went into the various Spanish speaking countries.
Right.
They were the first professional baseball team to go to Japan. Now, this is well before
yes.
Ruth and his All-Stars. The Philadelphia Royal Giants, a barnstorming Negro League team, go to Japan in 1927. Ruth and his All-Stars go over there in 1934.
Yeah.
And the Japanese love them. So
that must, I'm trying to, that's, that would have been a mind-blowing thing, you know, because, again, Japan is a still kind of a very homogenous society, right? And to have a bunch of African-American ball players show up in 1927 would have been,
it would have been
mind-blowing.
I think it was a little bit surreal for all of those guys, but they were treated so well. And you know, in Japanese culture, respect is so big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so these Negro League players didn't go over and try to beat them as bad as they could. You know, they play the 24-game exhibition series. They go 23-0-1 on the tour. But they didn't go over and try to beat them as bad as they could. They taught them how to play the game. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese fan absolutely adored them. And so we talk about a global game.
Mm-hmm.
And as you guys well know, when you look at a major league roster today, there's so many ethnicities from around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, really at the heart of it were the Negro Leagues. They helped make the game the global game that it is, and nobody knows anything about it.
You know, and one of the things that kind of fascinates me is one of the issues Major League Baseball is facing, obviously, is participation on the part of especially African-American athletes. You know, I think a lot of people think it may be changing. I mean, football's got a lot of issues, you know, especially concussions, concerns about concussions. Basketball, there's just a limited number of professional spots available. What has to happen, though, for African-Americans to become, you know, for baseball to become, I don't know if friendlier is the right word, but attract more of the real good African-American athletes? What has to happen, Bob?
Because we've certainly seen a decline in African-American participation in our sport for quite some time. And of course, baseball has recognized this and has started to try and put together a game plan to hopefully reverse this. We want everybody to be able to enjoy this sport. And so if there's a section of the population who is not being, if it's not being included, then we're missing out on great talent potential.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're seeing now, and we're right in the middle of this, Major League Baseball, the city of Kansas City, state of Missouri, building an urban youth baseball academy right behind the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. We're number 7. They've since now announced number 8 in Dallas. And of course, these are similar academies to what is being built in the Dominican and other places where kids will be put into a baseball environment. We want kids to fall in love with this game, but then make sure that they are privy to great training, great teaching, and hopefully they'll stay in the game. But you take away that economic barrier that has prevented a lot of kids from playing. Baseball used to be a blue-collar sport, you know, because we play at Sandlot. You know, and you didn't even have to have 9 people on the team. You know, you divide up whatever number.
Yeah. Hell, you can't even find a Sandlot now.
No, you can't.
Bob, as Major League Baseball fully embraced what you guys are doing in Kansas City, you know, again, it's I know there's they're interlocked, but parallel histories to a point, but became interlocked histories. We all know how Cooperstown is treated, you know, the kind of the shrine and of the game, and how you know how integral that is to Major League Baseball. What's the relationship been between the Negro League Museum and Major League Baseball over the years?
You know, we've always had a working relationship, and Major League Baseball has been a longstanding partner of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. But, you know, what we're hoping to do is develop a relationship that will be more sustaining over the course of time. And I think under the leadership of a current commissioner and Tony Clark over at the Major League Baseball Players Association, we're having those kinds of discussions to look at something that will be more sustaining in terms of a partnership. You know, we are a 501c3 not-for-profit organization, but when we look at our role with baseball, we don't want to be looked at as just a charitable contribution. Mm-hmm. We think that we can be a partner in this process, because if you want to attract urban athletes, and as we talked about, no sport holds to its history the way baseball does, well, how special is it for them to be able to see people who look just like them, who played the game as well as anyone ever played the game, but guys not only played the game, they were team owners, they were managers, they were coaches, they were traveling secretaries, team physicians. They fulfill every aspect of the business of baseball as well.
That's a great point.
Yeah, and so we want to create this holistic look at the sport from an African-American point of view.
How difficult, and not just specifically the Negro Leagues Museum, but sports museums in general, Bob, how difficult is it for them now to attract people through the doors? You know, because I mean, we've all talked about kids, you know, have devices, iPhones, I mean, tablets, whatever. They're playing video games. Has that been a challenge for sports museums and museums in particular to draw people into them? And what is the Negro Leagues Museum, I mean, what can it do, or what has it decided to do to try to attract those people?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges, not only for sports museums, but I think history museums in general, is how do you make the subject matter relevant? Kids are very savvy. Mm-hmm. And they have all these devices that you mentioned at their disposal right now. And so we're challenging ourselves to kind of be able to present this history in a way in which they can relate to it. And I think that's true for any history museum. If you're not doing that, you're going to get passed up in the process. Because, you know, a child will say, well, that was then, this is now. How does this impact me now? Mm-hmm. And I've got to be able to help demonstrate how what happened, you know, 100 years ago is still playing a part in what is happening to you right now. And I think that's very important. So we're looking at the technological aspect of it to be able to package the story, utilizing, you know, aspects of technology and, of course, getting current players engaged and involved with what we're doing. Because, again, and I go back to Ryan Howard, and Ryan I know is somewhere now on the latter part of his career, but he's been a supporter of the Negro Leagues Museum forever. And these young voices that we had Bryce Harper at the museum earlier this year, and he used Instagram to tell folks that I'm at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum and I'm standing next to Oscar Charleston with the Negro Leagues version of the MVP award, which is named for Oscar Charleston. All of a sudden now this resonates. Bryce Harper's at the museum. Maybe I need to come out and check this out.
How many Negro League veterans are still with us?
We guesstimate roughly about 100, 120, give or take. You know, guys are passing on that sometimes we don't know about.
Yeah.
And every now and then, one will surface that we didn't know was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that commodity is dwindling.
Yeah.
They're like World War II vets.
Yeah.
Many of them were World War II vets. I look back in Kansas City. When I first got involved with the museum, there were so many guys still there, including Buck O'Neill. And now they're all gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're all gone in Kansas City. There's not another Negro Leagues player in Kansas City. Only Bob Motley, who is the last surviving Negro Leagues umpire, is still in Kansas City.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bob, listen, we could we could spend the rest of the show talking about this. Luckily, if those of you are listening, Bob Kenrick will be at Pitch Talks tonight, and we'll continue this discussion. And, Bob, it's been really enlightening. We really appreciate you coming in and doing this, and I'll see you later tonight. And I'll say, as I've said time and again, and people have heard me say this, if you're in Kansas City, go to the Negro League Museum. It's a tremendous experience, and you will come away knowing a hell of a lot more than you knew going in. And I think we feel that way after our conversation with you as well. Thank you so much, Bob.
Guys, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.